Hello, and welcome to the last episode of Season 7 of Bad Gays, a podcast all about evil and complicated queers in history.
We did it.
How did that happen? We did it, Joe. My name is Ben Miller. I'm a writer, researcher, and a member of the board of the Schwules Museum in Berlin.
And my name's Hugh Lemmy. I'm a writer, author, and artist.
So last week we talked about the Baron Franz Napscha von Felser-Schilwasch. I got that name once again. The Baron Franz Napscha von Felser-Schilwasch, who was a eccentric Hungarian aristocrat who traveled extensively in Albania with his quote-unquote long-term secretary. Who are we talking about this week, Hugh?
Well, let me start by taking you on a little historical wonder.
My eyes are closed. Mind's eye is envisioning.
A stroll through time. So let's start today at the Hotel Santa Brigida, which is nestled in the beautiful mountains about half an hour's drive from Las Palmas on the island of Gran Canaria.
Sounds great. Could I also have like a glass of white wine and maybe an Aperol Spritz?
I mean, it's got a little pool. It's very nice. It's a very cute sort of four-star hotel in this small town with a sauna and pool and a terrace along its front.
This is where we're going with all the money we get from the Patreon?
Yeah, with rooms that open out onto a very nice long balcony that run the length of the entire building. So it opened in 1896 and has been plying its trade ever since. So now in our imagination, let's go back almost 90 years to the 10th of March, 1935. So political tensions in Europe are heating up. Earlier in the month, fascist Italy and Ethiopia had agreed to a neutral zone along the Ethiopian border of Italian Somaliland, as Mussolini had been building up forces in the colony ready for an invasion. The Saar Basin, a highly industrialized coal and steel zone, is returned by the League of Nations to Nazi Germany, aiding them in their rearmament. And in Britain, the Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, who'd been thrown out of the Labour Party after agreeing to lead a national government, a unity coalition, announced a new white paper justifying increased expenditure on British rearmament to meet the threat of Hitler. So that morning, housekeeping knock on the door of a room at the Hotel Santa Brigida. Hearing no answer, the housekeeper goes down and tells the hotel manager, who uses his key to open the door, and lying in the bed is the body of its inhabitant, a striking young English woman in her early middle age who was a guest at the hotel. The attending doctor puts her early death down to an overdose of barbiturates, although Lord knows, with her dissolute lifestyle, it could have just as well have been whiskey or even heartbreak. Later that month, she's buried in the English cemetery in Las Palmas. Soon after, a white marble tombstone appears on her grave. It's littered with mistakes, and its carving clearly wasn't personally overseen by anyone who knew her. Maybe her mother had paid for it, although if she did, it was the first time that she'd sent money for her daughter in quite a time, having cut off most of her allowance, having heard what she was up to. The tombstone reads, "In loving memory of Rotha Burley," which is a misspelling of Beryl, "Lintorn, Lintorn Orman, only daughter of the late Major Charles Lintorn Orman, the Essex Regiment, and granddaughter of the late Field Marshal Sir Lintorn Simmons. Ambulance driver, Serbia, 1916-17. Commander of the Ambulance Department, Red Cross, Devonshire House, London, 1917-18. Founder, British Fascists. Born 7th of February, 1895, died 10th of March, 1935. And that's it, a lonely end to a lonely woman, her grave marking her achievements that in other circumstances might have made her a trailblazer. The first British political party ever founded by a woman. Was the British Fascists. So how did it end up like this?
Gaslight, gatekeep, grill thus.
So Rotha was born Rotha Beryl Lintorn Orman in South Kensington, an upmarket district of London, at the end of the Victorian era, 1895. So that first Lintorn is her middle name. Her family, the Ormans, later changed their name by deed poll to Lintorn hyphen Orman in 1912 when she was 17, making her
Rotha Lintorn Lintorn Orman.
Rotha Beryl Lintorn Lintorn Orman. The name change was to honour her maternal grandfather, Lintorn Simmons, a highly decorated British Army officer who was really a consummate Victorian. A real military engineer by trade, Simmons had been the Inspector of the Railways, Secretary of the Railways Commission, and also Secretary of the Railway Department. During the Crimean War, he joined the army, fighting in Crimea, and also rising to become Colonel Commandant of the Royal Engineers, and eventually a Field Marshal. He was also the British Consul to Warsaw, and later the Governor of Malta and Envoy to the Vatican. Upon his death, he was honoured with a monument in St. Paul's Cathedral. Her father, who married Blanche Simmons, Linton's daughter, was Charles Edward Orman, a major in the Essex Regiment, which fought in the Boer War and in India, and he was also a cricketer. So this was the world into which Rotha was born. The British Empire stood astride the world as an imperial colossus, and her family were involved in everything that made it triumphant, its industrial, military, diplomatic, colonial, and soft power. So although she came from a conservative and highly orthodox Victorian family, she was growing up in a time of great changes for women. So throughout this last decade of the 19th century, there had been an increasing, although still marginalised, call for women's suffrage. When Rotha was 8, the campaign for their demands went up a notch when Emmeline Pankhurst founded the Women's Social and Political Union, a new organisation for women's suffrage which moved away from lobbying towards militant direct action. These women, who organised a campaign of heckling politicians, disrupting public events, chaining themselves to public buildings, and even arson bombing, were soon labelled the suffragettes. And in the run-up to the First World War, they were in full swing. And at the same time, a supposedly new phenomenon was emerging within the upper and middle classes, the so-called new woman, sometimes derisively known as the mannish woman. This was the emergence of a group of women who actively rejected the stultifying and very boring gender roles that were expected of them by bourgeois Victorian society, and instead engaged in the masculine pursuits of, for example, writing, journalism, cycling, and even living financially autonomous lives.
Whoa.
The horror.
This relates to the kind of 1920s new woman with the barb and the...
Absolutely. And... This is where it starts. Okay. And it evolves into the 1920s new woman. And yeah, the new woman really came into her own in the aftermath of the First World War, and we can talk about that in a bit. But this new mannish woman was partly a result of shifting economic forces, which the war had gone to exacerbate, and partly a moral panic encouraged by increased media literacy, you know, fears around the consequences of industrialization and urbanization.
This is the time when I can recite the lyrics of one of my favorite songs. Masculine women and feminine men. Who is the rooster and who is the hen? It's harder to tell these days. Voluminous trousers hanging so wide, nobody knows what's hiding inside. Those masculine women and feminine men, et cetera, et cetera. It's very funny. Look it up. Taylor Mack sings it really well.
Who's that by? It sounds like...
Is it socially conservative... late teens, early 20s, either British or American pop song.
Incredible.
This phenomenon that was recovered by Taylor Mack as part of Judy's 24-hour-long concert of American popular music. Yeah, really, really fabulous.
From the other side, of course, there's Noel Coward. I've been to a marvelous party, which goes in the other direction.
No.
Yes.
It was in the fresh air, and we went as we were, and we stayed as we were, which was hell. Anyway.
This is just basically enough of a moral panic alongside similar ones around, of course, like homosexuality. And... the male anxieties around the loss of status.
Nobody knows what's hiding inside.
Reactionary gender panics, fearing a sort of terrifying new contagion and harking back to an idealised gender norm in the past are nothing new. I guess the question is, were mannish women new? I kind of doubt it. I think the caricature of the mannish new woman, who was so panicking, the sort of fin de siècle male, sounds an awful lot like a description of, for example, the lesbian industrialist Anne Lister, who... dressed in austere black as she went around hiking the Pyrenees and investing in the railways and running a colliery, and that was almost a century earlier. So I think this is just a media fad more than a real shift.
Yeah, and also gender roles are so classed, right? The idea of the kind of...
a woman having a job.
The woman not having a job,
yeah.
Right? And being kind of delicate and existing in the domestic sphere, that's only true for certain classes of people, right? You know, working class women have been working
of course,
the whole time.
Yeah.
Like... and have been, quote-unquote, masculine in some ways the whole time.
Yeah. I think Anne Lister is actually a really interesting person to talk about. I think someday we should do an episode about her as well, because she was, of course, as well as being a pioneering woman in the industrial sphere, she was a Tory, a conservative, and an Anglican. So there's nothing, absolutely nothing really in the lives of such women that sort of wedded to them anything like the idea of a sort of radical or socialist cause. Like, maybe their lives were radical enough. Perhaps, to paraphrase James Baldwin when he talks about white gay men, they kind of felt that their gender had cheated them out of a birthright that their class and their race had bestowed, and they just wanted access to the benefits of that system, not to sort of change that system necessarily. But from an early age, Rotha definitely displayed a similar desire, if not to change the system, then at least not to be excluded from it. In the early years of the 1900s, inspired by the fever of imperialist swagger that was taking over Britain in the Edwardian era, a former British general named Robert Baden-Powell had come up with a new idea to implement imperialist and martial values into British youth. So based on his experiences in establishing Britain's colonies in India and in the south of Africa, and also upon the success of a book that he wrote about the practicalities of being a military scout, he established a new youth organisation called the Boy Scouts, and he published its handbook and Bible, which was called Scouting for Boys. There's almost certainly an episode waiting for him as well.
Yeah.
So the scouting movement took off as...
I bet he was scouting for boys.
The scouting movement took off as a largely self-organised phenomenon, but in 1909, just a couple of years after his early experiments with these scout camps, Baden-Powell organised a large rally at Crystal Palace in London for these new scouts organisations to come together, a sort of proto-jamboree. Rotha decided that she too would like to be a scout, alongside a number of other girls, so the year before they'd formed their own troop and registered as scouts, but using their initials rather than their first names to avoid detection as girls. And on the day, they turned up dressed in uniforms that they'd borrowed from Boy Scouts who they knew, and they went to a rally. Quote, "We marched up to the entrance, but we were told quite firmly by a steward that we would not join the rally," one girl, Nesta Maud, would later recount. She said, quote, "We didn't argue, but when the next troop of boys appeared and marched through the gate, they had two camp followers on the gate marshal's blind side. Once inside, no power on earth would have got us out," end quote. So Baden-Powell then approached these girls to see what the fuss was about. And while at first he wanted the girls ejected, he then promised that he'd think about it. And so the following year, he founded the Girl Guides, soon after publishing his own version of Scouting for Boys, with the even more problematic title, How Girls Can Help Build Up the Empire.
How Girls Can Help Build Up the Empire.
Yeah.
Okay. That's like gatekeeper girl boss.
So Rotha was involved in this first attempt, which really led to the foundation of the Girl Scouts, which is interesting. And one thing to note is also that, like with Rotha, the imperial fervour of Baden-Powell would also become a stepping stone into fascism. His biographer would later write, quote, "Baden-Powell's distrust of communism led to his implicit support, through naivety, of fascism."
Oh, yes, it was just naivety.
I mean, this is a 60-year-old or 60-something former Lieutenant General of the British Army who's commanded military operations on multiple continents. He's extremely well-read, published author of dozens of books. Like, it's amazing how much people can put down to naivety, like he's like a 12-year-old edgelord or something, rather than the fact that it's perhaps a logical extension of the politics of empire.
Just perhaps.
Anyway, Rotha was still a teenager when in 1914 a war erupted across Europe, the First World War. Nevertheless, she signed up for action. But unlike the young men of the time, it's not something that was necessarily expected of her by society. You know, working class women took jobs that had been vacated by men in factories, especially arms factories. And patriotic women of Rotha's class might be expected to take work, I don't know, in nursing or fundraising or morale-raising campaigns. But Rotha, age 19, joined the Women's Emergency Corps, which was a new organisation founded by a suffragette that looked to train women as doctors and motorcycle couriers and things like that for war service. And she was then transferred to the Scottish Women's Hospital Corps and was shipped out to the Balkans to drive ambulances on the front line. According to later accounts, she was actually honoured twice for gallantry for acts of heroism she performed on the front line at Drina in Serbia. And we don't really know what happened to her there, but like many veterans of the First World War, it certainly wasn't good, and it appeared to have affected her for the rest of her life, and she was actually invalided back to London, apparently with malaria, although it does appear that it was during this time she began taking more morphine for some unnamed wound. So in London, she recovered, and she took up a new position with the British Red Cross, where she was a commandant of the new motor school at Devonshire House, which was right where the Green Park tube station now is, on Piccadilly. So there's a photo of her from this time in a man's uniform, and I have to admit, it is rather striking. I'm going to find it for you, Bim.
All right.
So she's wearing a big trench coat that's held back by her hand on her hip, revealing a military tunic and a shirt and a tie held together by this big leather infantryman's belt.
Oh, work. And this is very masculine women, feminine men.
Right.
Where is the rooster and where is the hen?
Her hair is cut short and it's swooping down across her eyes like someone from a sort of Evelyn Waugh book of indeterminate gender.
Yes, or to use a degenerate American analogy, it's somewhat Justin Bieberish. on that kind of Justin Bieber lesbian continuum.
Yeah, and she's like glaring straight into the camera.
She's glaring straight into the camera. Extremely handsome face. Hand on the hip, big trench coat, this amazing leather belt, very, very thick broad leather belt. It's quite something, this outfit.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the cut of her jib is extremely androgynous.
Extremely androgynous.
And I have to admit, if I was a sort of 20-year-old nurse at the Red Cross headquarters doing a night shift in 1918 and she sort of swaggered onto my ward like that, I'm not sure I'd be able to resist her.
Yeah, look at that face. Look at the facial expression.
Yeah.
Zoomed in. It's really something.
I mean, she's kind of giving evil twink energy in her own way.
She is, absolutely. Lesbians can be evil twinks too. I think it's very important to clarify that.
So the trauma of the war, followed by its abrupt end, must have been a real shock for her. Having found both purpose and, I guess, acceptance in her identity and indeed credit and honour for her actions, suddenly she'd have been expected, like most young women of her age and class, to return to her very bourgeois existence and give up her career. Yet, like many male proto-fascists in the immediate post-war era, there was a very strong sense that the end of the war was not actually the end of the struggle, and that the communist revolution in Russia had brought a renewed sense of urgency to the task of political organising. As the academic Julie Gottlieb writes in her book Feminine Fascism, which has a really great chapter on this moment in British fascism, quote, "Memories of the roles played by women during the war were central to the definition of the movement and to constructing notions of self-worth. Right-wing women emerged from their wartime experiences with a renewed sense of patriotic endeavour, combined with a common sense that they did not want to abandon the sense of independence that World War had given them," end quote.
It's a kind of nightmare version of the feelings of self-organisation that Alan Berrabay famously argues sort of sparked gay liberation in the US in the 50s and 60s, right? That all these people had been in these homosocial environments, pulled out of traditional gender roles, and then realized that they liked it better, sort of settled together and began starting these gay ghettos.
Exactly, yeah.
And then the nightmare version is that when this happens to extremely upper-class British women who have upper-class British attitudes towards the working class and also towards empire and race, their desire for self-organization and militancy then turns very fascist very quickly.
Absolutely, yeah. And also, this was not a sentiment limited to Britain. Across Europe, the far right enjoyed a boom in popularity among returning veterans and among various classes of society looking to make sense of this cataclysm of the World War and especially terrified of the perceived threat of Bolshevism. In Italy, a journalist named Benito Mussolini formed a new political party that he hoped would sort of synthesize reactionary social politics with an attempt to replace liberalism and capitalism with a politics of the state, the nation, and the mass worker. This, he believed, was a challenge to the Marxist parties who advocated a policy of class over nation. Mussolini was not the first to theorise this sort of politics, nor was he the only one involved in the formation of these new parties, but his party, the Partito Nazionale Fascista, or National Fascist Party, was very successful. It galvanised support with its modern propaganda techniques and paramilitary violence. It used squads of black-shirted thugs to intimidate and assault trade unionists, socialists and communists. And in 1922, just a year after he formed this new fascist movement, Mussolini launched a coup d'etat. Seen as an effective bulwark against revolution by Italian conservatives and industrialists, the coup succeeded and launched more than 20 years of fascist dictatorship in Italy.
Yeah. Only a year after, wow.
Yeah. So Rother read about this new party with its bold, decisive leader and its sharp black uniforms in the British press.
Uh-oh.
And she was inspired. But one afternoon in early spring in 1922, she was gardening at her home on a farm in Somerset. And she had read that the Labour Party had sent delegates to a Socialist Party conference in Germany. And so she began worrying about the potential of international Bolshevism to take root in Britain.
Through the Labour Party?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, the Labour Party was in its very early days at this point. So she was digging in the garden.
Hannah, you have nothing to worry about.
Yeah. She was digging in the garden and then she was struck by this idea. If Britain's weak liberal traditions were not going to protect this green and present land from communism, then men and women like herself, patriotic and conservative citizens, would have to, by force, if necessary. So following Mussolini's lead, she decided on the spot to form her own political vanguard against the Reds. And she named it the British Fascisti. That Italian influence is clear there. It's quite a different story from that of Mussolini's, though. The author Edward White suggests that while, quote, there's no reason to doubt the sincerity of her anti-communist views, but perhaps what terrified her more than the thought of the Soviet flag fluttering over Buckingham Palace was the prospect of watching her life seep into the herbaceous borders, tending to nature, but never mastering it, end quote. In other words, a desire to return to action as much as an attempt to emulate the March on Rome was the driving force behind her decision.
Right.
I don't think it's an entirely unfair assertion, not least because while the image and name may well have been very inspired by the Italian fascists, the ideology was remarkably different and bore a few of the political and economic characteristics of corporatism and syndicalism that, for many people, had made Mussolini's party so attractive. But then one of the defining characteristics of fascism is its malleability to the unique social conditions of the countries that it emerged in. So although the Italian fascists and the German Nazi party had found common cause, you know, in territorial domination and anti-communism, they did differ significantly in many ways. But Rother Linton Ormond's party was more different still. Ideologically speaking, it was a sort of Tory party on steroids. I was going to say a Tory party on cocaine, but the Tory party on cocaine is the Tory party.
Allegedly.
So according to the historian of fascism, Richard Thurlow, quote, "The British fascisti reflected Rother Linton Ormond's own experience of the Girl Guides, public service, and a military background rather than any emulation of continental examples or ideologies. As a result, the BF was organised as a cross between a glorified Boy Scouts movement and a paramilitary group," end quote. Which sounds like a very sort of dismissive anti-fascist diss, but that was actually something that they themselves identified with. A later president of the group said that it was formed to, quote, "uphold the same lofty ideals of brotherhood, service and duty as the Boy Scouts." But it's quite a different ambition from, you know, march on Rome and seize the state.
Right.
Nevertheless, organising any political party, even one formed on the ideology of the Boy Scouts, is a huge operation. So her mother, Blanche, the daughter of this field marshal, got her daughter's new venture off the ground with a little bit of seed money of just £50,000, which is the equivalent to about £4 million today.
Oh, you know, just a little puttering around money.
Yes, yeah, her mother is really the mother of British fascism rather than her. So in that donation, I think, is a real clue to what's going on here. The British fascisti were sort of formed by the wayward children of this British elite and upper middle classes to protect their values. Unlike the Italian fascists, the idea of it being a group that could mobilise the power of the massified working classes in favour of the honour of tradition and nation and state was not at the core of their beliefs. Instead, it was formed to defend the pre-existing social hierarchy and core conservative values, motivated by fear of socialism and working class organisation, and maybe later, well, at the time, xenophobia and later anti-Semitism. It wasn't the only organisation to do this, of course. Other groups included the British Empire Union, and also the most British name possible for any sort of political group, the Middle Classes Union.
Oh my God. That's like the British equivalent of that US group, Moms for Liberty.
It's very similar,
you
yeah.
You need to know something about America to understand why Moms for Liberty is the most terrifying slogan you could imagine. Right.
Like, right.
Yeah. Same with the Middle Classes Union. God.
Yeah, the Middle Classes Union was formed in the aftermath of the 1918 Reform Act, which gave all working class men the right to vote.
Oh, heaven defend.
And that was their fear. So the strike action, the seizure of their property, and then soon enough eugenics because they feared the growth of the working class.
Hmm.
So it drew its members from the same class as Rother and her family, presumably through their social links with the elite. So the early members of the British fascisti were primarily high-ranking members of society, lords, officers, and things like this. So as an example, I'm choosing a handful, not based on seniority. Like if you're looking at seniority, there were the Tory peer Lord Ernest Hamilton and the Marquess of Aylesbury were members of the party. But rather, I'm just choosing these ones on the basis of how absurdly British their names are.
Not a Tory peer being a member of the fascist group. No. I can't believe that for a minute.
There are a number of Tory peers as part of the organisation. So we have such illustrious society figures as Algernon Temple Gore Langton, the 5th Earl Temple of Stowe. Baroness Zouche. Brigadier General Sir Ormond de la Epe Winter. And Admiral Sir Reginald Godfrey Otway Tupper.
Oh my God.
This is the vault
of the Tupperware Tupper.
This is the Volska mineshaft from which British fascism is drawing its eternal blood. The Zouches and Tuppers. So the party was organised at a national and at a county level. Eventually, like the Italian black shirts and the brown shirts in Germany, they developed their own paramilitary uniform with a blue shirt, a beret, and dark trousers or skirts.
Once again, even Patty Hearst couldn't pull off a beret, and she had money and a gun. So did Rother, right?
Right, but she couldn't pull it off. So it had this grand council with a president. The first president was Lord Garver. And it also had a party flag, a logo and a badge. And the badge is very telling to my mind. While the Italian fascists took as their logo the fasci, you know, the sort of bundle of bound sticks around an axe, which obviously harks back to ancient Rome, and the Nazis took as theirs the swastika, which supposedly recalls this entirely fictitious Aryan roots, the British fascisti took as theirs a black and white roundel with a white Yorkshire rose with a Christian cross in the centre, which was suspended over the centre of the roundel, which had in the centre the large letter F. And then around the edge of the roundel, the motto, "For King and Country." So I think this shows in many ways the sort of ideological manoeuvrability of fascism. They adopted the aesthetic tendency for nostalgia and grievance as the core driver of a political programme, but it's different in each country.
Right. And there it's sort of organized around the preservation of an existing ancient institution as opposed to the creation of a fictitious ancient institution in order to reorganize society around that.
Yeah. And the aesthetic is really a large C conservative, not just small C conservative, but a large C conservative image of England, of the county and of the king and country.
And the Yorkshire Rose.
So in 1925, Rother wrote this about the principles of the British fascisti. It's a little long, but I'm going to read it because I think it really gives a good flavour for where she's coming from. Quote, "The peculiarity about British fascism is that it has no past traditions to fetter its actions. It's based on certain principles and can therefore speak out in favour of what it believes to be remedial measures without having to explain its non-adherence to the previous declarations of weak-kneed exponents whose only desire was to shelve awkward questions. During the 2 years of its existence, certain basic principles have emerged, and on them its past, present and future actions are based. First of all, it's a definite challenge to put an end to the vile disease that has brought us to our current deplorable condition. Softness, sentimentalism, flabby compromise and thoughtless acceptance of catchphrases without examination as to their truth or falsity are amongst the main symptoms of the malady. What we want is a return to, all caps, virility. A fearless exposure of plain truth, and a determination to get the right kingdom regardless of immediate consequences. Fascists can and must show the way. It really is a matter of life and death. Surely there must be millions in this land who feel as we do. Let us be up and doing. Let us give up something of our spare time and resources for our country. And let the word go forth that we do not intend to allow faint-hearted politicians on the one side, or Moscow-driven traitors on the other, to wreck our homes, our lives, or the lands of our fathers."
But enough of this recent speech from the Tory Party conference.
You know, there's a lot of things there that still remain very important drivers in British political life, which is a sort of resentment of the idea that there's a political class that's out of touch and flabby and not making of important decisions. And also, of course, a really strong sense there of the idea that they represent a silent majority. Everyone's thinking this, but the common sense of the average man has been left behind.
If you take the word fascist out and put the word Brexit in, it genuinely sounds like a Daily Mail article.
Not a million miles away, I'd agree with you.
The kind of thing that will be written by, who's that vile person, you know, goes around parading herself as Britain's strictest headmistress?
Exactly, yeah.
Like that really is giving that.
Yeah, it really is. And also, but at the same time, whereas in Italy you have this sort of like bombastic fascist movement calling all men to reach for the gun and take and join the army and...
give up a bit of your spare time.
Yeah, yeah, something of our spare time and resources. It is very much, why not bake a cake for the church fate or something in its tone. It's very weird.
Yeah. Little Britain fascism.
Exactly. So in keeping with this peculiarly English attitude and chauvinism, they actually renamed themselves just British fascists rather than fascisti because it's too Italian. And the party was to grow considerably over the following 5 years. Its official membership figures are vastly overinflated. In 1926, during the general strike, it claimed to have 200,000 members in Britain, which would have made it about the same size as the Labour Party at the time. Later on, they'd claim almost 1 million, which is just ridiculous. But it was quite successful. In 1925, it had membership fees of around £7,000, which is about £500,000 in today's money. And they organised rallies and they published newspapers, and they would also act as security for meetings of the Conservative Party to avoid them being disrupted by communists. Some Tory MPs did denounce them, but they did receive considerable support from a number of other Conservative MPs.
Shocked, I tell you. Yeah. I am shocked.
Who even booked them rooms for them to use and have as meeting places in the House of Parliament.
Shocked, I tell you. I am kind of appalled to discover that there has been fascism going on in this Conservative establishment.
In 1926, the British fascists provided 600 paramilitaries as stewards for a Conservative Party rally at the Albert Hall, and they marched their flag into the centre of the hall as Land of Hope and Glory played. But most significantly, probably for the Tories at least, was their commitment to anti-trade unionism. This led to one of the many ideological splits in the party when the general strike began in 1926. Rother offered the Organisation for the Maintenance of Supplies, which was this right-wing official strike-breaking group that was aimed to coordinate deliveries during the strike. She offered them the support of her followers and also a fleet of cars in order to drive people who were scabbing to work. The Home Secretary, however, then threatened to resign from the organisation if it accepted the British fascists' offer, because he objected to this very vague commitment within the British fascists towards a corporatist state. And then the president of the British fascists, Robert Blakeney, actually agreed with him, and so he attempted to rewrite the party constitution to explicitly state its belief in parliamentary democracy. But Rother refused, and she managed to win enough party members over to stymie this constitutional change. And then Blakeney quit the party. And then on the other side of the party, on the right of the party, another splinter group broke away from the party, complaining that the name change and this blabby, ill-defined ideology wasn't close enough to Mussolini's fascism, nor was it anti-Semitic enough for their tastes. So they formed this new group called the National Fascisti. And interestingly, a later recruit to the National Fascisti was one Colonel Victor Barker, a trans man who we did a special episode on with Juliet Jakes a few years ago, which is worth listening to. So she's pretty bad, and she's clearly, if not butch, then androgynous in her presentation, which made her a subject of ridicule, even from members of her own party at times. But conversely, her gender presentation became an object of focus for the authorities, not really as a serious transgression for them, but almost a reason for them to regard her as not a threat at all. They thought, like, this is silly butch women. But was she a lesbian? That's the question really for us. So in a lot of sources, especially in less academic publications, she's claimed as one, but there isn't much in the way of evidence. But of course, queer history is kind of full of these problems. And at some point, we have to make our own understandings around what people are talking about or what they're bringing to the table to make an intelligent guess.
Yeah.
For example, Asa Saracen, talking about that Julie Gottlieb book I mentioned before, Feminine Fascism, remarks on an anecdote about her dressing in, quote, male clothing for a Christmas party. He writes, "In a book that features the word lesbian only once, in a footnote, it's hard not to read the extremely vague phrase, quote, her preference for women in uniform, which could refer to transmasculine inclinations, lesbian eroticism, or a general fervour for patriotic conformity, as deliberate obscuration. Nonetheless, the image conjured is as clear and painful as it needs to be. A person whose existence was so restricted, and whose choices were so misguided, that one of the few places they felt able to express their gender identity was a fascist children's club Christmas party, where she'd gone in drag as a man." I did find, actually, though, a very interesting primary source on an extremely fucking stupid fascist website, but it was a photograph of a book that had belonged to Mary Sophia Allen, who was a fascist, a lesbian, and founder of Women's Policing in the UK, who we talked about in the Cressida Dick episode.
Right.
And this is a scan of this book, and it seems very believable, very plausible. I don't know why else you would produce it. So the book was called Women at Home, which was published by The Home magazine. It was like an annual. And it appears Rother has inscribed it to, quote, "To dearest Mary, with all my warmest and heartfelt good wishes. Yes, you are so right. We women must learn to love one another. So with my fullest love, Rother Linton Ormond, London, 1919. And love has been double underlined in both instances. And furthermore, within the book, on an article inside entitled Women Living with Women, written by someone called Christine Jope Slade, about women who were living together without their husbands during the war, Rother has made annotations. After the sentence, which reads, "They are acquiring by necessary all the rough ingredients of comradeship, which makes for a wider independence and a bigger recognition of individuality than is usual in married life," Rother writes in all caps, in all capitals, "Please." And then she notes by its side how true and purposeful, she writes by the side of the article. And then when the author writes about the pleasures of these, quote, "interludes of sheer Eve," Rother notes in the margin, quote, "Mary, I adore my interludes of sheer Eve. Ah." So assume the book is genuine, and I think it would be a very weird thing to forge.
Does she adore her interludes of sheer Eve?
Well, all I'm saying is my gaydar is really pinging at these sentiments.
Do we have a sense of why this fascist website is promoting the story of these two being gay for one another?
So I don't want to link to the website because it's like just straight Hitler worship bullshit, but it's from some American fascist website, which also does a lot of like glamour shots of women. I don't know, there's some weird Nazi fetishism that's released from maybe some of the actual political side of it. I don't really know, but like, yeah.
That's so strange.
So Mary Sophia Allen was 17 years older than Rother, who was in her early 20s when the book was printed. But nonetheless, the idea that they know each other isn't unusual at all. Both were stationed in London at the end of the war. Mary was running a women's policing training school and Rother was running the Red Cross motor station. You know, they're both in leadership positions. Both were in the very unusual position of being professional women in leadership positions, and both transgressed the norms that were expected of young women at the time and also gender norms. And perhaps most persuasively, both also shared far-right politics. But there's plenty that's interesting about gender within the British fascists. Although Rother wasn't the party leader at the start, she was the founder and she was the leader of the women's units. But they did, there was a unique role, I think, of women in the British fascists, unlike other British fascist movements. Women were always at the highest echelons of the party. And what's more, the party organised specifically and heavily with women. It was the only party with an all-women's paramilitary unit, for example. It organised something called the League of Empire Housewives, which was a sort of consumer action group which provided literature and also pins for women to wear to identify to shopkeepers that they were only going to buy British or British Empire products, so they shouldn't be given anything else. And they also organised the Fascist Children's Club, which ran these social and educational programmes for children. And the BF claimed that, quote, "Women especially should make it their task and duty to prevent the spirit of the Red Menace to influence the future citizens of the Empire," end quote. She had then gone to describe how in 1927 she had gone to the East End with a troop of 15 fascist women to try and round up support to start a new fascist children's club there. But she ended up getting trapped on a railway station by a group of Reds, as she would call it, but also by a crowd of 200 children from the East End, whereupon, quote, "The children started throwing things at us."
Go, children from the East End.
The kids are all right. However, following the exit of Blakeney as the leader, as a president after the general strike, Rother herself assumed command of the organisation, and things really started to go downhill from there. According to Richard Thurlow, she had, quote, "a tenuous grasp of reality," and the party began to shift even further to the right, adopting an explicitly racist ideology, while moving further from mainstream conservatism. "Fascism will replace milk and water conservatism," Rother wrote in 1932. When she'd started the party about 10 years earlier, she had the claim to be the only fascist group around, but by the early 30s there were many groups, some much more organised and better funded than the BF. And in 1931 came the British Union of Fascists. Well, it started as this thing called the New Party, but then became the British Union of Fascists, which was formed by the former Conservative, Independent and Labour MP Oswald Mosley. So in its earlier stages, Mosley had attempted to bring the BF into his new party, but this caused the most serious rift yet for the BF. Many of its male leaders supported the merger, seeing a better organised party with more clearly defined fascist principles and goals, but most of the female leaders, including Rother, opposed it, partly on the grounds that they saw Mosley's economic principles as too close to socialism, but also, according to Edward White, because they knew that within the British Union of Fascists, women would not be able to play such a key role in the movement. But the leading men left and they took most of the membership with them, allowing Mosley to jibe at them from the podium that the British fascists were, quote, "just three old ladies and a couple of office boys." But it wasn't just the politics, but also Linton Ormond's behaviour which helped convince many fascists that the BF was a busted flush. Bankrolled by Mother Dearest, Rother's life seemed increasingly dissolute, with accounts of orgies at her home and party offices. And since the First World War, Rother had struggled with substance abuse problems, probably as a result of her morphine addiction.
There's your Volksgemeinschaft.
Yeah.
Orgies and morphine.
The special branch, which is part of the British police that sort of deal with political dissidents, kept a file on her. And they noted in 1933 that they were approached by a friend of hers who alleged that, quote, Some of the members of the organisation were constantly plying Miss Linturn Orman with drink and drugs with a view to extracting money from her. End quote. Her mother then stopped funding the BF altogether, and then she cut off most of her daughter's allowance. And when her mother was visited by the special branch at her home, she said she was, quote, of the opinion that drunken orgies and undesirable practices take place at her home residence, which has been loaned to her daughter, and that some of the leading members of the BF are living on the latter's allowance, end quote. By 1934, the party was in desperate shape when one of its supporters demanded the return of a £500 loan. Unable to pay, he took them into bankruptcy, and Rother then went into rehab. And the next time she appears in a historical record is the following March, when she dies alone in the Hotel Brigida, barely a month after her 40th birthday. You're listening to Bad Gaze, a podcast all about evil and complicated queer people in history, and we'd just like to take a moment to thank all our supporters over on Patreon.
Yeah, it wouldn't be possible without you, and that's why we now have for Patreon supporters and Apple Podcast subscribers a new monthly podcast called Extra Bad Gaze, and that's where we have more informal but still informed conversations about hot topics, current issues, current events, current culture, but we do it with that same analysis that makes the show. So this last month we just talked about this new gay Fire Island nightmare community that they want to build in the Mediterranean. But it ended up becoming a much deeper conversation about the history of gentrification, about gay men's complicity in it, about how it affects queer communities. And that's the kind of analysis you can expect from the show, along with episodes about Diva Down George Santos and our favorite and least favorite gay Christmas movies.
And if you still feel like you haven't had your fill of Bad Gaze, why not check out our book, which is available now, Bad Gaze, A Homosexual History, in hardback or paperback. And it's also now available in Italian translation and coming soon in Thai and in Spanish.
And that's at badgazepod.com/book. And our Patreon is patreon.com/badgazepod, or click subscribe in Apple Podcasts. Back to the show.
Well, Hugh, thanks for that. A really incredible story of a truly awful person. What were the attitudes of the British fascists around gender and sexuality? Because, of course, we know that in many places, fascist movements were specifically organizing with and in and trying to kind of bring together this backlash against the new woman, against changing gender roles, against, you know, masculine women and feminine men. Were the British fascists promoting this kind of women should be women and men should be men line with their leaders as a kind of exception, who were finding, you know, freedom somehow within the highest echelons to advocate for something very different from what they advocated publicly? Or were the British fascists for this reason leaving those themes a little bit more out of their organizing?
They obviously believed in strong gender roles and a split between the roles and purposes of men and women, but they believed more than, I think, than a lot of other fascists and conservatives in extremely active participation of women in the organization. I said how much. You'll see from some of the things I quoted, like this obsession, I guess, with virility, and also a lot within the British fascists of the idea that the women were a threat from socialism, from this red tide. And also that Britannia, as this feminine personification of Britain, was at threat. And part of the reason that they're at threat is because men had let down their side of the bargain. So while women had a distinct gender role within the organization, it wasn't necessarily secondary or passive. They were sort of saying, like, why are you leaving it up to the women to do this? Come on, men. We have to do this, but this is your job. You should be out here to shame almost men into further militancy.
And it does seem as zeroed, you know, despite this very sort of androgynous image that we have of Rother, you know, in the book with Mary, she's writing in the margins, you know, Eve time and all this other. It seems like it is a very sort of lesbian identification. She identifies as a woman. She's not Victor Barker, right? She's not
absolutely
trans masculine.
No, I don't.
There is a kind of boyish or butch presentation that is part of the thing that we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely, within the context of her time, what would be seen as gender divergent, or what we'd see as gender divergent behavior, like the way she was presenting and stuff. She's written about frequently, both by members of her own party and by others, as a spinster. That's how she's contextualized. I mean, you know, she's quite young at this point at the start of the party, I think the implication there might be around something to do with that she's already renounced men. You know, like, like, of course, someone of her age and class would be expected to be married very young. But I feel like someone who's 23 is still not necessarily yet in spinster territory. I don't know about that. I think it seems very clear to me that the way she's self-describing and her relationship with women seems to be very specifically lesbian rather than, yeah, transmasculine.
Is there something about British high-class white feminism that makes it, like, extra fascist?
Thanks for an easy one. I think there's something about the British elite that makes it predisposed to extremely authoritarian moral action, right? And whatever the nature of that politics, so when the nature of that politics is feminist, it performs in that way. Do you know what I mean? So, and I think there's very interesting roots. I mean, we talked about it a little bit in the episode on Crest of the Dick, and I can really recommend the Asa Sarasin article, Lesbian Fascism on Turf Island, which is on his website, asasarasin.com, because that really traces a lot of these roots around gender policing and sexual policing. So you get something emerging in the late 19th century, which is this first wave feminism. It's very much based around upper class women policing the morals of working class women. And that's kind of how a lot of that movement emerges. But at the same time, I don't think that's the feminism. I think that's the class position. And even then, there is myriad examples in British society of women and feminists of that period of a similar social class moving much further to the left and taking, in my mind, much better politics. Sylvia Pankhurst, for example.
Yes, yes.
Or indeed the Mitford sisters, who one day, somehow, I'm going to squeeze, maybe through the brother, Tom, but squeezing an episode about the Mitford sisters, who are this fascinating, super fucked up example of a British aristocracy, one of whom was a Nazi, as in friends of Hitler Nazi, and her sister, who she shared a bedroom with, was a communist of the Marxist-Leninist variety, who ran away to the Spanish Civil War to try and kill fascists.
Oh, wow.
So Decca Mitford, Jessica, is an example from this exact milieu, who goes on and, you know, is very involved in left-wing organizing and takes a much more radical feminist position.
Another great example here is, and this is definitely spoiling a future episode of the show, but Siegfried Wagner, who's Richard Wagner's son, who's himself a bad composer, but also a conductor, who then ends up being pressured to marry. He marries an English woman, Winifred Klindworth. They have four children. Siegfried Wagner dies in 1930, and Winifred is the one who, like, invites Hitler and really aligns the family legacy totally with fascism and is an extremely enthusiastic fascist.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she's English.
Right. There are all sorts of variants of different forms of feminist organizing, even within the upper classes. And of course, like, within the working class, drives towards feminism in England are much more motivated by a left-wing position.
Of course. So Rotha Barrow Lintorn Orman. Good, gay, bad, not gay, bad. I think we can agree on bad. But...
Definitely bad. And I think fair guess to say gay. But also a really sort of tragic termination to the life. Very sad story as well.
Yeah, as many fascists end up do, which of course doesn't excuse what they do with what they've been given.
No, they deserve it.
So what were some of the sources that you used to research this episode? Maybe ones that aren't on American Nazi websites?
Well, there's Colin Cross, who wrote a book called The Fascists in Britain, which I used extensively. And also Fascism in Britain by Richard Thurlow. And then there's the fascinating book, which Asa Sarasin also quotes from, which is Feminine Fascism by Julie Gottlieb, which goes a lot more into some of the theory around gender, which is well worth a read if you're interested in that sort of thing. There's also an Edward White article called Conservatism with Knobs On in the Paris Review. Do you remember that Patricia Lockwood tweet at the Paris Review? So is Paris any good or not?
Well, yeah, I think that, crazily enough, brings our seventh season to a close here. We've made 80 hours of this show.
Yeah, with all the specials included. And it's been really interesting and fun.
It has been. And don't worry, we are still having fun and finding the stories of new bad guys. So we're not going anywhere. Stay tuned for season 8 coming sometime this year.
Yeah, we have a long list of hundreds of bad guys. But if there's any that you particularly find interesting and think we might have missed or might be able to do an interesting episode on, please do drop us a line. And also, we've launched this year our new podcast, Extra Bad Gaze, for subscribers to our Patreon, or also available on Apple Podcasts for subscribers.
And that's great if you want a little bit more regular content, because as it turns out, when you make a show that does not require writing and researching 5,000-word episodes, you can do it more often. Amazing realization that we've had 7 years into this.
Yeah, and on that, we're chatting about, I don't know, queer culture, things that are happening in the news, queer politics, George Santos, queer Christmas films,
the
all sorts
Fire
of things.
Island.
The new Fire Island. So if you'd like to help support the regular show, which is still free and will remain free for anyone to listen to, but if you'd like to get a bit more extra and support the regular show, then do subscribe to Extra Bad Gaze.
Yeah, now that we're both off Twitter for our psychological health, it's a place where you can find some of our hotter takes. And with that, you can find the show online at Bad Gaze Pod. You can find me online at benwritesthings.com and Twitter at benwritesthings.
And you can subscribe to my newsletter at hugh.substack.com.
Until next season or next month's Extra Bad Gaze. Bye.
Bye.
Bad gaze.